Hello, my name is Susan Piver. I'm founder of the Open Heart Project, and it is my pleasure to offer you this brief talk followed by a meditation practice. Today, our talk is on right livelihood, the fifth of the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path. In all cases, I am delighted to see you, and I look forward to sharing a few thoughts with you. We started by examining the Noble Eightfold Path, and we started with the first step, right view. The Noble Eightfold Path is among the original teachings given by the Buddha upon his attainment of enlightenment. This very first teaching he ever gave was on the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, life is suffering, which doesn't mean life sucks. It means everything changes, and that is really disconcerting. That is painful. However, it is the truth. The second noble truth is called the cause of suffering, which basically means pretending that the first noble truth is not true, and therefore grasping, trying to hold on to things and keep them permanent, or keep them away from you permanently, is considered the cause of suffering. The third noble truth is the cessation of suffering. Yay. Now that you know the cause, grasping, you know the cure, stop doing that. How do you do that? Well, and then we get to the fourth noble truth, which is our subject. The Noble Eightfold Path explains how to do that. So we began by talking about step one, right view, seeing things clearly. Then we moved on to step two, right intention. When you see things clearly, the right intention arises naturally. And these first two, right view and right intention, are considered a pair of topics that relate to wisdom. So the first two steps on the Eightfold Path are about the accomplishing wisdom through right view and right intention. Then we come to right speech, using your speech wisely, right action, letting the actions that you take in the world, the way you show up, reflect right view, right intention, right speech, and so on. So it's not just what you say, it's what you do. And today we come to the fifth step, right livelihood. So as mentioned, the first two, right view and right intention, are about wisdom. That's the ground. This next three, or the set of three that we're concluding today, right speech, right action, right livelihood, comprise the three steps that are called ethical action, acting as a moral being, an ethical person in the world. How do we do that? Through right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And then the final three steps on the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, right meditation, and right concentration, comprise a subset called samadhi, or meditative consciousness. So how do you achieve wisdom? Right view, right intention. How do you show up as an ethical being in the world, contributing to the greater good? Right speech, right action, right livelihood. How do you accomplish a meditative consciousness in every moment of your life, meditative awareness, through right effort, which we'll look at in 2 weeks, and then right meditation, and finally right concentration or absorption. So just giving you a little bit of the lay of the land. But our topic today is right livelihood. And this is very interestingly complex. So just starting with the basics, the traditional view of right livelihood is don't have a job or you have to kill beings, where you make poison, where you manufacture weapons, and so on. So that's pretty straightforward. I'm sure none of us want to make weapons or poison beings or be murderers. However, it's just not that simple. I had a friend once who worked at a huge company that one piece of the company was a weapons manufacturer. All the other pieces of this vast company were not involved in weaponry, much more noble pursuits. And my friend had an incredible job that enabled her to take care of her disabled child, fully supported her in that, gave her all the time and space she needed while paying her a handsome sum, which she really deserved. So what is she supposed to do? So, you know, I'm just pointing out that there are complexities here. But by the same token, if you're, there's simpler ways to understand it, and then there are the complexities. So we might then move on from that and think, well, right livelihood means I should engage in work that benefits others. And yeah, that's a great notion, for sure. One might further think that that means working, being of service, or working in a hospital, or tending to the mental sorrows of others, things that are directly and observably about benefiting others. And that's great too, clearly. You will get no argument from me. Sometimes I talk to people that despair about their capacity to attain right livelihood because they work at a big company, or they have a job that makes widgets that aren't particularly bad, but aren't super great either. And I just want to say that the way you show up for your work is the foundation of right livelihood. Do you show up with an open heart, with the intention to be a benefit, with awareness of the people around you and their struggles and their wins? Do you care about them? Do you care about the actual work you're doing? Meaning you take care, you approach it responsibly, you make sure you understand the tasks at hand, you make every effort to accomplish your work thoroughly and beautifully. I would say that counts as right livelihood. You know, again, there's gray areas. If you're doing all that and you're making weapons, some further review is indicated. However, I would just start with, how do you show up at work? I sit at my desk every day. I'm pointing because it's right over there. And I sit there by myself. So what do I do? Well, you know what I do because you're listening to me right now. But still, even though I spend most of my day by myself in semi-solitary pursuits, I'm making this video, but I'm the only one in this room, except my cats. I talk to people. I work with other people. I have to request customer service from PayPal or other entities that I use for my business. And I try to do those things kindly. Which begins with bringing my full attention to what I'm doing. So something might happen, obviously, this is super first world, where some website plugin stops working and I have to ask for help. And I might be irritated. Why? Because I'm human. So can I work with that irritation and just go, okay, I'm irritated, that's cool, no big deal. Let me not share that irritation with the person on the other end of the phone or the live chat or whatever the means of communication is. Those are good things to begin to pay attention to. So it's all about, how do you show up? What's in your heart? How willing are you to open to the people around you and to the tasks at hand? Because it's not just about the relationships. It's about the work itself. Are you giving your creativity a chance to express itself? Are you taking care with this piece of the work and that piece, and this piece you like, so I want to spend time with it, this piece I don't like, so I don't want to spend time with it? Nonetheless, can I bring my goodness, my good-heartedness, my care about the quality of my work? Can I invest that in all the aspects of my work? That creates beauty and decency and a sense of wholesomeness in your work environment. Now, work is obviously more complex than I'm presenting it, but nonetheless, these remain good questions to ask yourself. Can I show up in this way with a sense of dignity in my work and the way I hold myself in the workplace? When it comes to money, all sorts of other questions arise. And I'll just speak from personal experience. As a Buddhist teacher, a meditation teacher, a person who's also a woman and self-employed, there's all sorts of, I think the technical term is mishigas around money. Am I worth? What am I worth? I can't ask for that. I'm scared. I am. I'm scared. My work is about me and you and putting myself out there, and there's no buffer, and it's scary when your work is you. At the same time, it's a profound blessing, and I would have it no other way. Nonetheless, there's all these things to encounter, and often those things center around money. What is it okay that I ask for money? What if this doesn't work? What if it does work? All the things. And especially if you're in a helping profession or working in a the area, I guess you would call spirituality, there's often an expectation that you should do it for free. Or if you charge, whatever it is you charge should be, I don't know what, humble? And yeah, nobody should be gouging. But there's a expectation, I guess I'll just say again, that if you offer something spiritual, meditation instruction, for example, that it should be free. And that if it isn't, that it's not right livelihood. Everybody in this space has to wrestle with that question. I've given it a lot of thought. So just for what it's worth, throughout much of history, as I understand it, of people giving meditation instruction, it has been free. And part of the reason, at least for that, is that the people who taught it were monastic. They lived in monasteries. They worked their monastic hinies off, but they had a place to live. They had food to eat. They had clothes to wear. So sure, if I could do it for free too, if someone was giving me a place to live and all those things. But that's not the world we live in. So how do I, Susan Piver, figure that out? So, it's been now 6-7 years since I started the Open Heart Project. And what I realized is that, I want to live inside and I want to have food to eat and so on. And this has turned into my full-time job, which is my choice. So I have to figure out a way to derive income from it. And I try to do it very fairly and all that. But that's a small point. The main point is that when Buddhism arrives in New Shores, as it has for the last 2,000 years, 2,500 years, it mixes with the dominant culture. It doesn't try to supplant it. It doesn't try to pose as it. It blends with the dominant culture, and it transforms the dominant culture and is transformed by the dominant culture, which is very interesting. So when it arrived in Japan, it mixed with Shinto and became Zen. This is all very broad strokes. When it arrived in China, it mixed with Chan. When it arrived in Tibet, it mixed with the Bun tradition. There are Bun elements in Tibetan Buddhism. And now it's here in the West. What is it mixing with? I think that's a really interesting question. One might think, well, it's going to mix with Judeo-Christian values, and that may be true. But as far as I can see, those are not the values that dominate our culture. Rather, consumerist values are the values that dominate our culture. Our culture runs on consumerism. Good, bad, ugly, all the things. So now Buddhism is here mixing with consumerist culture. Well, that's tricky. That's very tricky. So there'll be some of us who forget the Dharma part and really focus on the consumer part. And there'll be those of us on the other end of the spectrum who forget about the consumerist part and just focus on the Dharma part. We might be living outside someday. So can we do both? Can you do both, no matter what your job is? Can you honor your need to make a living, to value yourself, to support your family and others, while basing it all on your heart's desire to be of benefit, to express yourself creatively, to offer something good to the world? Just being a Buddhist teacher is not the only, that's not the only job where these questions are germane. So those are important questions that we as Westerners have to ask ourselves, that I guess throughout much of the history of Buddhism for teachers anyway, this question was not as appointed as it is right now. Vast overstatements. So now, just going back to the original point about Buddhism and consumerism, consumerism will change Buddhism, not the Dharma, but the delivery, as we can see now. Hi, I'm talking to you in a video. The more tantalizing notion is that consumerism could be changed by Buddhism. So part of my commitment, and this is all about me, so may not be relevant here, is to the noble challenge of trying to model a successful business that runs on Dharmic principles without being a liar, without fooling myself, without fooling you. This is my vow. So anyway, I hope this is useful. Just begin to draw your attention to what you do in your workday, whether you work at home as a parent, or everybody works, or whether, you know, you're captain of industry or a dog walker or whatever it is that you do all day long. Just bring your attention to the question, is this right livelihood? Not to critique yourself, but more to remind yourself to bring your best, your full attention, your good-heartedness, your brilliance, and your confusion to the way you spend most of your waking hours. I'd love to hear what you find. So let's sit together. I'll guide us through a 10-minute practice. Begin your practice by forgetting about everything I just said, if you haven't yet. And take a good posture. You can sit with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, or you can sit in a chair. And if you sit in a chair, sit with your feet flat on the floor. And let the hands rest on the legs, palms down. Sit up straight and contact your own dignity in so doing, your own worthiness, your own wholeness. No matter what is going on in your life, in your world, in your day, you remain completely whole and worthy and beautiful. See if you can feel that. Let the front body relax, the belly can soften, and let the shoulders relax. The chin is tucked a little bit, so the back of the neck is long and the mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth can be slightly parted. That helps the jaw to relax. And the mouth is closed because you are invited to be silent, which is rarely an invitation that we receive. So I issue it to you now. I invite you to just be silent. It's quite delicious. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, meaning there's no breathing technique, just how you're breathing is fine. The eyes are open and the gaze is cast down to a spot in front, up to 6 feet or 2.5 meters or so, or less, whatever works given the distance of your screen. In all cases, the eyes are soft, very soft. And there's a sense of receiving through the eyes rather than searching through the eyes, just taking in. You can imagine that the eyeballs rest back in the sockets a little bit, whereas often it feels that they're straining forward, so just, you don't have to do that, they can just rest. And let the brow relax. Let your attention rest on the breath, which does not mean notice the breath. It means feel the breath. Feel the body breathe. Inhale, exhale. The body expands on the inhale and lets go on the exhale. Can you feel that? That's the practice, feeling the body breathe. Your mind will continue to make thoughts. Of course, that's what it does. Like the eyes see or the ears hear, the mind thinks. Cool. There's no effort to stop that or change that. Or quiet that, or anything that. Just blah, blah, blah. It's just happening. It's fine. Most of your thoughts will come and go without really distracting you from your breath. You're still with the breath. And a little thought here, a little thought there, fine. However, if you notice that you become absorbed by a line of thought to the point where you've forgotten about your breath, like you spaced out your breath, that's also really good, because you just woke up and saw where your mind was. So the instruction here is notice that. Label that thinking. Let go. Doesn't matter if the thought is important or trivial or horrifying or beautiful. Irrelevant right now. Just let go. Gently come back to the breath. And begin again, feeling this inhale, this exhale. So this is our practice, and we'll sit together until you hear a little gong. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart. I thank you for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. I feel it. And thank you for practicing together. The Open Heart Project is around 20,000 people all over the world meditating for more compassion, wisdom, and courage. I am so happy to be on this path with you.